So we'll take a break there and look in chapter 23 after break. Chapter 23, and Paul, earnestly beholding the council, said, "Men, brethren, I have lived in all good conscience before God unto this day." They didn't like this phrase at all, simply because this was putting Paul on equal ground with them. Although they weren't living in good conscience, they still didn't want Paul saying this at all. I mean, in their own conscience, they knew they wasn't. It's like Jesus told the same type of people that without let him without sin cast the first stone, and their conscience bothered them. But here Paul could make this statement. The word for conscience here comes from a compound Greek word, asun, which means together, to know together. I think the thought that we have in this would be to collect your thoughts, that my thoughts were honest before God. I think that would be probably the best rendering of that. Anyway, and the high priest, Ananias, commanded them that stood by him to smite him on the mouth. Notice in John 18, this is what they did with Jesus. I think verse 22, 18:22, smote Jesus on the mouth. You know, they did the same thing here to Paul. Said Paul unto him, unto the high priest, unto Ananias, "God will smite thee, thou whited wall, for thou sittest to judge me after the law, and commandest me to be smitten contrary to the law." He called him the whited wall. Notice in Matthew 23, get the idea of a whited wall, verse 27. "Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for ye are like unto whited wall sepulchre, which indeed appeared beautiful outward, but are within full of dead man's bones and of all uncleanness." Outward they were white and beautiful and perfect, but inside they stunk, full of death and uncleanness. And he called them hypocrites. Essentially, this is what Paul was calling the high priest here, a hypocrite. He was a whited wall sepulcher. Outwardly he looked good, inwardly he stunk. Ananias knew what he was talking about, and so did everybody else around him. I don't think Paul read the book on how to make friends and influence people. He commanded to be smitten contrary to the law. And they that stood by said, "Revilest thou God's high priest?" Then said Paul, I knew not, brethren, that he was the high priest. For it is written, "Thou shalt not speak evil of the ruler of thy people." And this was the law, Exodus 22:18. "Thou shalt not speak evil of thy people." But notice Paul said, "I knew not, brethren, that he was the high priest." The word "was" actually should be "is." It's in the present tense in the Greek. "He is the high priest" should be rendered. But then Paul said, "I didn't know." Anybody would have known that Paul knew who the high priest was. And he knew Ananias was the high priest without doubt. Well, did Paul lie here then and say, "I didn't know he was a high priest"? No, not in any way. He didn't lie. Because as Paul was concerned, he was not the high priest. Jesus is the high priest. And the Aaronic priesthood was done away with when Jesus died on the cross. And now the only priesthood that was left was the Melchizedek priesthood. And Ananias surely didn't qualify for that. This was not an apology, as some people think. It's a statement that I didn't know that he is the high priest. For it is written, the law says, not to say anything evil concerning the rulers of the people. And when Paul perceived that the one part was Sadducees and the other part Pharisees, he cried out in the council, "Men and brethren, I am a Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee, the hope of the resurrection of the dead. I am called in question." Use a little wisdom here. I believe that God revealed this fact to him. He surely knew this, that part of them were Pharisees and part Sadducees, but I believe God revealed to him what would happen if he stressed this point. The fifth chapter of Acts, verse 17. Read, "At the high priest rose up, and all that were with him, which is the sect of the Sadducees, and were filled with indignation." So those that were with the high priest, we read here, were of the Sadducees. Then in verse 30 and 31, we read, "And God of our fathers raised up Jesus, whom you slew on a, and hang on a tree." Peter used the same wisdom here, is the point I want to make out. Some of these were Pharisees and some of these were Sadducees. Peter stressed the fact of the resurrection of Jesus from the dead. And then notice in verse 34, Gamaliel stood up in the council and defended Peter. This is the same thing as happening here. Paul is setting at odds the doctrine of the Pharisees and the doctrine of the Sadducees. Then in verse 7, And when he had so said, there arose a dissension between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and the multitude was divided. You take a house divided against itself, can't stand. Strove saying, "We find no evil in this man, but if an angel or a spirit or an angel has spoken unto him, let us not fight against God." See, they changed their tune now. And when there arose a great dissension, the chief captain, fearing that Paul, at least Paul, should have been pulled in pieces of them, commanded the soldiers to go down and take him by force from among them and bring him unto the castle. So again, Paul was delivered. He was saved from the clutches of his enemies and brought back into the castle. Then that night, verse 11, Jesus came to him. Isn't it wonderful to know that he never leaves us and never forsakes us, no matter where we are? The night following, the Lord stood by him. We've got somebody standing by our side. And he said unto him, "Be of good cheer." You look this phrase up sometime in the scriptures. And most of these times that these are used in the scriptures, it's pretty rough time. And times that most people aren't very cheerful. And the Lord comes by and says, "Be of good cheer. Be courageous, Paul. For as thou hast testified of me in Jerusalem, so must thou bear witness also at Rome." Now Paul knew, without any doubt, he was going to go to Rome. And there was no way that these people could kill him before he got to Rome. So let him holler all he want to and say what they want to, there was no way they could kill him. Now the thing that Paul was to do was simply walk in the Spirit so that he would say the right thing at the right time that God could use even his enemies to get him to Rome. It's amazing, when Paul went to Rome, he had the government pay carfare all the way. He didn't have to do it himself. And then when it was day, the next morning, certain of the Jews banded together and bound themselves under a curse, saying that they would neither eat or drink until they killed Paul. Well, I'll tell you, they got pretty hungry because he lived a good many years. I suppose they broke their vow, but they bound themselves under a curse. They made a conspiracy, said that they would neither eat or drink until they killed Paul. Then we read in verse 13 that there was more than 40 of them that joined in this conspiracy. Verse 14, and then they came to the chief priests and the elders and told them about this conspiracy. Said, "We have bound ourselves under a great curse, that we will neither eat nothing until we have slain Paul." And not only did they make it, but they told the priest. Now this was a confirmation of this. Not too long ago we were studying in Exodus concerning vowing a vow. Or was it? No, it was, I'm sorry. It was in Acts, 21st chapter of Acts. We just talked about vowing a vow. Anyway, we had the instructions on that when something was said in the presence of God, God expected them to do just what they said, and there was a penalty for not. And so they didn't do this. We don't read what happened to them because they didn't do what they vowed to do. Verse 15, we read, "And now therefore, ye with the council signify to the chief captain that he bring him down unto you tomorrow, as though ye would inquire something more perfectly concerning him. And we, or ever he come near, are ready to kill him." So we're going to set a trap now. The high priest, which should represent God, he should represent love. He wore he was to wear the stones upon his breastplate. Upon his heart, he should have been carrying the people on his heart. So you can see the apostasy here, can't you? Was conspiring also kill Paul. And so he fit in with their plan, kill him. But God had someone on the scene. God always is a step ahead of the enemy. Remember that. No matter how things look, God's always just one step ahead or more. But he had a young man here on the scene. And when Paul's sister's son, his nephew, heard of their lying in wait, he went and entered into the castle and told Paul. And then Paul called one of the centurion unto him and said, bring this young man into the chief captain, for he has certain thing to tell him. So he took him and brought him into the chief captain and said, Paul the prisoner called me unto you, prayed me or asked me to bring this young man unto thee, who hath something to say unto thee. And then the chief captain took him by the hand and went with him aside privately and asked him, what is it that thou hast to tell me? Then he told him. One thing I want us to look down through here, notice the phrase young man used in verse 17 and 18. And this doesn't tell us how young the man is. But I think the phrase in verse 19 would tell us. And the chief captain took him by the hand. Now, can you see the chief captain taking a 20-year-old by the hand? Or even a 15-year-old by the hand? To me, this speaks that he must have been a pretty young boy. But do not thou yield to them, for they lie in wait for him of them more than 40 men, which have bound themselves with an oath that they will neither eat or drink until they have killed him. Now they are ready, looking for a promise from me. They are ready to kill him, and waiting for a promise to bring Paul down to the chief priest. Such a good plan goes haywire just because God had a young boy on the scene. You know, I was thinking too just now, sometimes we don't think we're too important. Do you ever feel that way? Well, I'm just not doing anything. I'm not very important. But it's good that God could use this little fella at the right time to overhear the conversation and save Paul's life. Just to be used of God in a small way, an insignificant way. You know, if he had never done that, he wouldn't have been recorded in the Word of God. So the chief captain then let the young man depart and charged him, see that thou tell no man that thou hast showed these things to me. Don't tell anyone that you came here and told me. And he called unto him two centurions, saying, make ready 200 soldiers and go into Caesarea, horsemen 70 or 70, and spearmen 200 at the third hour of the night. 270 men were used to take Paul to Caesarea. He was going to be doubly sure that these 40 people didn't get a hold of him, wasn't he? 270 men. And they left about 9 o'clock that evening. Time started at 6 o'clock. Third hour would be 9. And they rode all night. They provided them beasts. And this probably included one for Paul to ride on and one and some for luggage and whatever they might have needed. We don't read anything what happened to Paul's luggage and whether he still had it or what happened to it. But he provided them beasts that they may set Paul on and bring him safe unto Felix the governor. Notice the difference between the horseman and the beast. They surely didn't give Paul a nice, but anyway, there is a difference between the nice horse and the beast. And they brought him safe to Felix the governor. And then we read of the letter that was written. And also we read of the chief captain's name in verse 26. Claudius Lysias unto the most excellent governor Felix sendeth greetings. If you read the chief captain's letter and read the account that we have just read, don't know, I'm not too sure whether you would recognize them or not. People, when they write letters, always like to make them slant toward their own benefit, don't they? So we read, this man was taken of the Jews and should have been killed of them. I think the better rendering of this was about to be killed of them. Then came I with an army, and I rescued him, having understood that he was a Roman. Now this was a downright lie, you see. He didn't know he was a Roman until after he was going to beat him, but he surely wasn't about to tell Felix that. And when I would have known the cause wherefore they accused him, I brought him forth unto their council, whom I perceived, isn't that interesting? Real good writing. I knew in my mind to be accused of questions of their law, but to have nothing laid to his charge worthy of death or a bond. And when it was told me how the Jews lie await for the man, I sent straightway unto thee, and gave commandment to his accusers also to say before thee what they had against him. Farewell. And then the soldiers, as it was commanded them, took Paul and brought him unto Antipatris. Now this was a little town. It's the only place that's used in the Bible, by the way. Not used anywhere else. But it was a little town northeast of Joppa, a little ways. And actually, it wasn't much more than a man's castle. It had a name. And this was named after one of the Roman Empire's father, her father-in-law. Anyway, it was just a small place, about halfway between Jerusalem, a little more than halfway probably between Jerusalem and Caesarea. But it's far enough away to get away from the Jews that were there. And then on the morrow, they left the horsemen to go with him, and they returned to the castle. So all of them, except the 70 horsemen, returned back to Jerusalem. And they stayed with Paul, who when they came to Caesarea and delivered the epistle to the governor, presented Paul before him. And when the governor had read the letter, he asked of what province he was. And when he understood that he was of Cilicia, said, I will hear of thee, he said, when thine accusers are also come. And he commanded to be kept in Herod's judgment hall. This was a real nice place. It wasn't a bad place.